speaker, David G., who has a great story. Thank you.
Good morning. My name's David. And I'm a grateful Al-Anon. Happy to be here today. I came to this building about 10 and a half years ago. I was out of ideas. I was out of solutions. I was out of energy. I was out of everything. And I think it showed. I had a wife that was pretty out of control with her behavior with drinking and just with everything. We didn't have any honesty left between us. We were broke. We both made great money, but we never had money. We had three kids, and I was raising these kids pretty much by myself and trying to run a business, and I was just spent. I had tried everything I could to fix it. That's what I want to do. I want to fix it, right? And so I came here as a last resort. I thought, well, it's either get divorced or come here, you know, and I came here. And then later I got divorced, so. But you know, I want to speak just a little briefly, because a lot of over 10 years of this recovery has made me really look at how did I get in this situation? Like a normal person, I don't know really what normal is, maybe I shouldn't use that word, but you would think that if I was married to someone who was lying to me, I would set some kind of boundary or take some kind of action or something. Or if alcohol was just such a predominant theme and we couldn't get away from it, you'd think I would find some way to move on, and I couldn't. I could not. I was absolutely stuck. And later it was suggested to me that she was addicted to alcohol and I was addicted to her. And I think as soon as I heard it, I knew that was true. I just didn't know how that happened or how to get out of it. I didn't want to be addicted to anything or anybody. I just wanted life to be, you know, normal, healthy. One of the things I really got hung up on in all our arguments is I kept coming back to, but I'm right. You shouldn't drive the kids drunk. That's a no-brainer. I'm right. But that logic, even though I'm right, nobody cares if it's right. It doesn't work, you know? So anyway, I grew up in a very small family. It was just my mom and my older brother and me. My dad, my biological father, left about the time I was born, so I didn't know him very well. And my mom was into alcohol and what she used to call light drugs. And marijuana and other things, and she usually wasn't at the house, and when she was with her friends who were doing the same thing. So it seems odd, like I never really think people believe me when I say this, but I grew up pretty much on my own. I was unsupervised, which I thought was really cool at the time, but it had some bad effects. My brother was a very angry person from real early on, and he and my mom fought constantly. And I don't know if it was ordained by the universe or if I volunteered for the role, but my job was to keep the peace. My job was to try to make things right, try to fix things. They haven't talked in like 7 years. I don't think I fixed anything. So I often joke and say, I come from a small family. There's only three of us, and the other two aren't talking. So because of that, I didn't have a network of family or support. I didn't even really know that existed until I got older and started going to my friends' houses. And there was just a lot of stuff I didn't know. I was probably antisocial, but I didn't know it. It's really a bad deal to be an antisocial extrovert. That's hell. You know? Very conflicting. Because I love people, but I just didn't know how to do it. And so I grew up that way. It was a tremendously lonely and unsupported place, not to, you know, do the Al-Anon violin, but it was. And the reason I say that is because when I was 24 and I met my wife, she filled a pretty big void. And it felt amazing. She was intelligent and beautiful, and she was plugged into that mainstream in ways that I wasn't and I didn't know. I loved her and she loved me. I mean, tell me what doesn't feel better than that. How are you not going to be addicted to that, you know, when that's your whole life you've been trying to fill? And as I come down here over the years and listen to alcoholics speak, they talk about this void that they experienced, and I think it's the same thing for me. I just picked a different substance, I guess, or I don't have that tick in me or whatever, that allergy for alcohol, but that's okay. I've got plenty of other things to express it on. So when we met in our 20s, we could just clicked like wildfire, and we, I mean, within 3 months of knowing each other, we were living together, and a few years after that, we were married, and we had about 6 years that were just extremely fun and wonderfully healing and fulfilling. All of our friends wanted what we had. We were kind of the model for, you know, what people talked about. If they had relationship problems, they would come to us. Wow. Haven't thought about that in a while. And so we had a lot of fun. We drank a lot of alcohol. We ate a lot of food. We went to a lot of parties. We had a lot of friends. I mean, it was fun, fun, fun. And then we had our first kid. And I think there was something in me, you know, I don't come from any family history to speak of, but I just knew that when you have a kid, you kind of stop drinking, and you start changing diapers and reading Dr. Seuss books, and you just go to the next chapter. And so I transitioned to that chapter, and she didn't. And I was horrified, and I was angry, I was pissed off. I was like, come on, let's do the parenting thing. And she continued to drink and drink and drink and party, and I was like, well, maybe there's some way we can balance the two. But really, the balance was me doing everything. And so I wound up progressively resentful. I didn't know that about myself, but I was getting really, really pissed off. You know, nothing will make you angry like changing your 13th diaper in the middle of the night, you know, when your alcoholic's passed out on the couch. So we had another child soon after that. So it was kind of like having twins, and I was overwhelmed. 5 years later, of course, that would be a great idea to have another child. And so I've got three of the best kids in the world. I'm sorry if anybody else that has kids, but mine are actually the best. Always had a great relationship with them, but increasingly as time went on, you know, all the craziness of alcoholism happened in my family, and I don't really have to tell the stories. You guys probably know them better than I do, but, you know, I knew police by their first name, and, you know, we had all kinds of IRS problems, and I mean, just affairs and just name it, you know, it's just all the crazy stuff. And there I was just trying to fix things again. I was always trying to fix it. So when I came down here, I just thought, surely there's got to be a way, since I'm right and she's wrong, these 12 steps must be a way to show her that she's wrong. That's how I thought of it. And when I first walked in, I was quickly corrected, by the way. I was told that these 12 steps were for me, and I remember being highly offended at that prospect, since I wasn't the one with the problem. But actually, what I know today, and what I've known for some time, is I did have a big problem. I still have it. It's still in me, and I still keep coming back to get better and better. I didn't know how to set any kind of boundaries with people, and I walked around feeling like my wife or anyone else, that no one really respected me. And I felt that way because, drumroll, they didn't respect me. Because I never set a boundary in my damn life. I never said no to anybody. I didn't really know where my limits were. I just tried to fix things. I tried to please. I tried to, you know, peace at all costs, right? Well, the cost was me. And so this place started kind of teaching me how to be an adult, like make adult decisions, actually decide where I stand on things and what my boundaries are and are not. And I told this story the other night of this night. I've been coming to Al-Anon for a while, and this night where my alcoholic got really hammered. And she threw up in our bed and passed out. And I came back and realized I couldn't sleep on my bed, and I was really angry about it. So I slept on a couch, and I was laying there angry. And figured out that there was nothing really to be angry about. I mean, this is what she does. This is what she does, and my continued choice to just clean it up, so to speak, figuratively and literally, you know, those were my choices. And it got to the point where, you know, I had to love myself more than I loved her, just for a minute. You know, that always felt like a terrible betrayal, but I had to love myself just a little bit more than I loved her at that moment. And so I woke up to her waking me up. She felt horrifically guilty about what had happened, although it happened many times before. And that was the morning when she decided that she was going to get dressed up and come down to Club 12 for her first meeting, her first AA meeting. And she knew that I came down here on Saturdays. It was a Saturday morning. I used to come for the 11 a.m. all the time. And so she said, you know, can you get up and get dressed and let's drive down there for my first meeting? And the way I described it the other night is it's kind of like an Al-Anon's dream, to see your alcoholic, take a shower and say, let's go to a meeting. That's like what we've been waiting for the whole time, right? But because I've been coming down long enough, I knew that was really, really important for me not to be linked to her first meeting or her recovery. So I said, we've got two cars, I'll see you down there. And that was really big for me. It's like this moment of independence, but I experienced something that I've experienced many, many times when I set boundaries. People don't like it. Nobody likes to have a boundary set on. And she was really offended that I said that, because that wasn't how we did the dance. We did the dance like this, As long as you're like this, then someone's got leverage on you. And when I exercised a little independence, it was really offensive to her. And I've seen that in other people as I've learned how to kind of stand up for myself a little bit more. But it's uncomfortable for me. A place of comfort is if you're happy. If you're happy with me and I'm happy with you, then I'm comfortable. And I tend to gravitate towards comfort. But what I've found is that the familiar may be comfortable, but if it was working for me, I never would have come down to this place and met you people. So over the years, I just learned more and more how to make my own choices, and I focused on my kids, and she kept drinking. And I remember one day my sponsor told me, I would call him with these ridiculous, frantic, anxious moments. What do I do? What do I do? I'm going crazy. And he said, look, when you do X, Y, and Z, she drinks. I remember at one point thinking, well, should I drink? Should I stop drinking? Should I drink with her? Should I not drink with her? What do I do? And he was like, if you drink, she drinks. If you don't drink, she drinks. I mean, she pretty much just drinks. So, my whole premise of my question was faulty, that somehow we were linked. She was going to do what she was going to do, and I've learned to do what I'm going to do. I never used to be that way before. I was always adjusting for you. No offense, but I don't do that anymore. I love it when people are happy, and I love good relationships. The irony of it is that when I try to control all that stuff, my relationships all went to shit anyway. And it wasn't just my wife. It was really everybody. I didn't really know that about myself, but when I started making changes in Al-Anon, lots of different relationships changed, and a lot of people filtered out of my life. And that felt terrible because I don't like losing people, but I've seen it as all, there's got to be some master plan to it. So one day I call my sponsor. One of the things that Al-Anon really helps me with is, even though I'm not on the AA side of the line, there's a tremendous amount of denial that goes on in my thinking and what we sometimes call Al-Anonism. And I was telling my sponsor, I was detaching. My wife used to get drunk in various places and pass out in various places, and a lot of times she did this outside. I don't know why that was her MO, but she loved to go outside and pass out. And my job for many years was to get her inside so she could be passed out inside. I don't know what I accomplished there, but so I told him I was going to stop doing this. She used to go out on our back patio with this great back patio, and she would pass out there. And so I just let her lay, and it was the hardest thing in the world for me. It's a hot South Texas summer. There's mosquitoes all over the place. And she's going to wake up at 8 o'clock just with bumps all over, and I would go lay down in bed and just stare at the ceiling. Like, I couldn't see. I'm supposed to be just going on with my life, but I just stare at the ceiling, wondering about her mosquito bumps. That's how crazy I was. And so I would tend to look at her through the windows then, so I made myself close the blinds. I just close the blinds. She's going to do what she's going to do. And then one night I called my sponsor, and I was peeking through the blinds looking at her. Because, now, I know it's funny, but when she would pass out, she would get this really irregular breathing, and it would look like, not just her breathing, but everything about her looked like she was about to die. Like, I'm not being dramatic, she would look like she was about to die. And so I would watch her breathing, watch her chest kind of go up and down, and would stop, and kind of hold my breath, and then her chest would come in. So I called my sponsor. I said, I was going crack. I don't know what to do. I said, well, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm not on the patio. He said, well, what are you doing now? I said, well, I'm watching her through the blinds. And he said, well, what are you watching? I said, I'm watching her breathe. And he said, I'll never forget, he said, you're watching her breathe. And I said, well, when you say it like that, it's just, it sounds crazy. He said, all I'm doing is repeating your words back to me. So that's what program does, that's what community does, that's what sponsorship does. Standing up here or sitting out there listening, you know, it's like I get to throw my words up on the wall and I get to really see them and hear them stick. And it's different when you're in a room by yourself, miserable. I don't hear so good. My sponsor has said some of the boldest, rudest things I think I've ever had ever heard from anybody, and yet I love him to death, you know. Just things that I've needed to hear, like you're watching her breathe. So eventually, her disease progressed, and my independence progressed, and I got closer and closer to get the strength. It took about 5 years for me in the program. In Al-Anon, they say, you know, don't make any big life choices in your first year or first 6 months. And for me, it took about 5 years just for things to progress and for me to build the strength and independence to really think about leaving. And at the end, I just felt like I was so hopelessly addicted to this woman that it was going to take something special to push me over the edge. And then that happened. She got into crystal meth. And she got into a type of meth called candy meth. It was packaged like candy. And I found candy meth on my floor in my house with 3 candy-eating children. And I was like, I'm out. You know, I just couldn't do it. It was really a, kind of a strange thing, too. Talk about control mechanisms in my mind. I found this crystal meth, but I don't know anything about drugs, so I didn't really know it was crystal meth, but I knew something was going on with it. I found 3 little balloons, and there were little candies in each balloon. I'm kind of a drug idiot. I mean, I don't know anything. So I go out on the internet, and I start Googling, and I find some information about candy meth and how it's real popular among middle-aged women in suburbia and all this stuff. And it's so strange now. I was obsessed with proving to myself. I had to know if that was crystal meth or not. Like, that was really important. So I thought about calling the police, actually. And I called my sponsor, and he said, you call the police, you know, they're in the business of arresting people in possession of crystal meth. That's a good point. And he could hear the ridiculous anxiety and illogic nature of what I was saying and thinking. And I was telling him, I just got to know it's crystal meth. I mean, if I'm going to make this decision, I just got to know. And he said, all right, David, I want you to do an exercise. Close your eyes and picture, I'll never forget this, such a son of a bitch, but he said, picture the biggest candy store in the world with every flavor and every color and every candy imaginable. I said, okay. He said, you got it? I'm like, yeah, I got it. He said, now how many of them come in balloons?
That's good.
So I called a lawyer. And that was really the day that I decided to move on with my life. Moving on was not easy because I wasn't the only one that was codependent. In our relationship, she was too. Her name is Jenny, and I could barely start a sentence without the word Jenny. I would come down here, and people would say, how are you, David? And I would say, Jenny's drinking again. And they would say, no, but how are you? Jenny drove the kids drunk again. It was Jenny, Jenny, Jenny. One of my sponsors made me say my name 17 times just to get the attention on myself, and he asked me to do that multiple times a day. It was a little embarrassing at times. But anyway, it got the focus back on me. And she was kind of fighting the same thing. On top of that, she had drugs and alcohol going through her veins, so she really wasn't thinking clearly. So when I did make the move to file for divorce, she fought it. She fought it really hard. And she's a very intelligent, very capable person, and she became a formidable opponent. And I went through a 3-year divorce battle and child custody battle for my kids. There never should have been a day that they lived being driven drunk or with drugs on the floor or seeing her passed out all the time or just all the various things that happened. And the really interesting thing is that when this happened, when I filed for divorce, she fought it and we went to court and the judge ordered her out of the house. Immediately, my relationship with my kids improved. And I didn't see that coming. But I think they were just waiting for me to be an adult, be the adult, make some decisions. And ironically, actually fix things. I was so busy trying to fix things, I didn't fix things. You know what I mean? It's like I had my eye on the wrong thing. But we fought it out in court for 3 years, and I got to learn a whole nother lesson in powerlessness. It was really hard because the way our legal system is set up and family law in this country, the lawyers, nothing against lawyers, I'm sure there's lawyers here, there's no offense, but what my experience was is that they just sucked out every dollar until all the dollars were gone, and it took 3 years to do that. And then I had three teenage kids, and 5 years ago I was pretty much starting over at the age of 45. And that's what I fought for. I felt really kind of a whole second wave of anger because I fought really hard to then be stuck with the challenge of starting all over again. But again, it's just a bunch of self-pity. What I can tell you today is I lost my business, but I have a way, way easier job today. And I lost my house, and I have a way better house today. And it's still in the same school district. My kids had the same schools, which was always a big goal of mine. Got me out of a neighborhood that was full of people that were drunk themselves, were all part of the drinking network that went on. Life is so much better today. I've got some friends here that have seen me on both sides of that, and they can tell you. I mean, it's so much better, but yet I fought that so hard. Sometimes I just fight what's good for me. Am I the only one?
No.
So I'm just really excited to be here today and every day that I've come and every meeting I've been to and every sponsor I've had and every sponsee I've enjoyed for over a decade now. And if you're new to this program, I just want to say that in these 12 steps and the verbiage here, the words we or our or us are repeated 19 times. 19 times in 12 steps. The point is, you're not alone. I came down here, I thought I was so miserably alone. I thought I was going to come into some little closet space where a couple of people met. I came down here, there was like a damn HEB, all you people. how recognizable and normal this story is. But I'm so happy that you guys have been here to catch me. You've been that incredible net. And so now I try to do that as much as I can for others. Thanks.